struck me so forcibly in writing the history of the Percys was the consistency of their family values, problems, and pursuits over a 200-year span, but even more the family's heroic response to suffering, setbacks, and regional calamities. The family history illustrates that to overstress the melancholy of artists, and even those with conventional careers, serves unjustly to diminish their integrity and contribution to later generations. After all, as Herman Melville pointed out in Moby Dick, to trail the genealogies of these high mortal miseries, we must needs give in to this, that the gods themselves are not forever glad.
Historian and biographer Bertram Wyatt Brown. He's here to talk about his new book, The House of Percy, an account of honor, melancholy, and imagination in a Southern family. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Walker Percy is among the prominent artists of American fiction in the 20th century, noteworthy for his finely crafted prose and his psychological insights. Both Walker Percy and his family are the subjects of a new book by historian and biographer Bertram Wyatt Brown. Writing about the Percys from multiple perspectives and tracing the family from the 18th century into the present, Wyatt Brown describes the Percys' inherited inclination to despondency, their abiding sense of honor, their extraordinary artistic gifts, and their civic and political contributions to Southern society. Bertram Wyatt Brown teaches at the University of Florida. His new book is The House of Percy, Honor, Melancholy, and Imagination in a Southern Family. With the first of two excerpts from his book, here's Bertram Wyatt Brown.
With the exception of Walker Percy, the novelist, no other member of the family in the United States ever matched the subtlety and individuality of William Alexander Percy. Unpretentious and self-effacing, he exercised an extraordinary influence upon those around him. In his adult later years, men and women of wit and intellect filled the guest rooms of his house in Greenville. Equally important in the family annals was his articulation of the Percy sense of honor. From his father Leroy and from his own studies and personal needs, he was to develop a stoic outlook, a determination to confront the battles of life with courage and to accept defeat as an inevitable result of great action. Yet idealizing honor in this form had its drawbacks. To win acclaim within the household and in the public arena as well required an agonizing struggle for perfection. But Will Percy strove against the frailties of human nature itself, not only to develop in himself virtues that Percys and the Southern public could respect, but also to set an example of noblesse oblige for others to follow.
Bert, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the National Humanities Center. We're going to revisit a topic that we talked about a number of years ago. Here's your book, The House of Percy. How are you doing these days?
Well, just fine. It's been quite an effort to get this book out, but I'm glad to see the end of The House of Percy.
Well, I remember that when we talked about it before, we called it The Percy Legend or words to that effect, and now you have chosen the title The House of Percy, and you use these three very important words, honor and melancholy and imagination. Tell me about honor in Southern families.
Well, this is a family that I think exemplified a cultural trait that you find throughout the South, and even today. I think that honor is an aspect of Southern life that is not very well understood in America, but it has been there all along. I think it came with the founding of the colonies back in the 17th century and has continued to be a part of the ethic of the Old South and of the modern South as well.
I noticed that on the cover of your book, Bert, you have a figure here. He is called the Brooding Knight. This takes us back to the Middle Ages, aristocracy and the concept of honor indeed. How about it?
Yes, I think there's a connection between the title of the book and the Brooding Knight, as you see there. Actually, I took that picture myself. It's it's over the grave of Senator Leroy Percy, who died in 1929, and his son, William Alexander Percy, obtained this commission from Malvina Hoffman, who in the 1920s was one of the leading sculptors in New York City, and she was the one to cast that bronze. He, though, was the one to come up with this idea of a medieval knight, And that is connected with the family itself, because, as I title it, the House of Percy, that refers actually to the Northumberland Percys, the medieval family that actually were there even before the William the Conqueror arrived. Harold invited the first Percy over from Normandy, Algernon Percy, to
now, let me
be
stop
the,
you. Let me stop you for a minute. Is it possible to connect this family to young Hotspur and the Shakespearean expression of the Percys?
That is certainly a legend within the family itself. And I just recently learned that Senator Charles Percy of Washington, D.C., who's now retired from politics, his branch of the family always considered their relationship to George Percy, who was the second governor of Virginia after Captain John Smith, as the founder of the family. But actually, there's been this tradition in the family itself that that the first American Percy, who came over here in 1776, was related to the House of Percy in Northumberland.
Now, Bert, how do you bring together three large words like honor and melancholy and imagination and organize them around, what, a chronology or a genealogy? What I'm leading you to is the question of, I guess the word is determinism, that these things manifest themselves. They have to manifest themselves in this Southern family. What about that?
Well, I think that we can speak of national character. Americans have a certain style. The French have a style, the English, and so on. Regions have styles, and we speak of a Southern style or Southern way of life, Southern living, if you will, the magazine. And I think the same is true for families, that you can go to family histories and find that cultural patterns within the family will be carried on for generation after generation. And you'll find, particularly this is so in the South, where families of farmers, say, will go on, you know, my pappy was a farmer, my grandpappy, and so on. We've been on this land for, you know, for 150 years. And there's pride in this, and it gives a family a sense of identity. We've come away from this, of course, in modern times, and people very often don't even know where their grandfather lived, and yet there's a great industry about this. Genealogy is a flourishing business today. And so their desire for roots, I think, is a way of dealing with change in society and finding continuities in one's own family history. And that's what I have in mind with this family.
Now, the passage that we heard you read just a moment ago, which describes Walker Percy, the novelist's, his uncle, or is it his cousin? It is his cousin and the man who raised him. Is that, have I got that
right? That's right. It was his first cousin once removed.
And actually, that's Will Percy.
But they called him, to make things confusing, the children whom he raised after the death of their parents, they called him Uncle Will.
Well, what I'm leading you to again is the volatility of this man's personality as a sort of an emblem that manifests itself throughout these six generations of the Percy family. We are not trivializing when we say that that this is an instance of how unpredictable these concepts and interchangeable these concepts are of honor and melancholy and imagination.
Well, I think they are very much connected. In this particular family, this is a family of unusual quality, both in terms of moral quality and intelligence. In fact, genius, you might say, a literary genius, because what I found in dealing with the family was that not only do you find such a great novelist as Walker Percy in the lineage, and Will Percy, his first cousin once removed, who wrote the famous Lanterns on the Levee in 1941, a classic of Southern literature, but also that there were Percy novelists in the 19th century. There were four novelists, all of them women, but related to the family, and in all of these instances, both male and female authors, there was a concern with both the question of honor and the question of melancholy.
Let's open a brief parenthesis, Bert Wyatt Brown. I notice at the beginning of your book you talk about the sort of slippery slope that a historian faces when you begin to explore and write about these very deeply personal issues, the problem of objectivity and the problem of subjectivity, the book is here in front of us. I take it that that is a problem that somehow or other you faced, but describe it for me very briefly.
Well, of course, a family has its own view of itself, mm-hmm. and that view is going to be quite different from someone observing from the outside. Just as American historians say, look at English culture, they're going to find things that are weaknesses and maybe even some strengths that the British wouldn't recognize. They wouldn't recognize themselves. And I think that may be true in this case, and probably true for any family history. Families know their internal dynamics much better than the outsider can. Mm-hmm. And so I was very conscious of the fact that I was looking at it from the outside. And that was partly also because of the nature of the materials that are available. Only certain documents are available to the historian, those that have survived. There are many, many questions that have never been written down, or answers to questions that have never written down.
Let me bring you to Walker Percy mm-hmm. himself. You say again that he is the most recent manifestation, so to speak, the most famous
yes.
of the Percy line. Do you find, Bert, in this man the embodiment, the crystallization, a kind of concentration of these themes of honor and melancholy and imagination? Either attack or defend that as a proposition.
There's no question about it. He inherited from Will, in a sense, or at least he grew up in Will's house in Greenville, and absorbed Will's philosophy of Stoicism, which is the most refined aspect of the concept of honor.
Uh-huh.
Honor, in this case, is noblesse oblige, the obligation of the rich to help the poor, the obligation to serve one's country, to serve one's neighborhood, one's city or community.
Let me stop you for a moment,
yes.
Bert. Is the language of the Percy family, and by the language I mean in the documents and the sources, mm-hmm. the traffic that you investigated in writing this book, is it that explicit that a family would talk amongst itself about a large word like Stoicism? I mean, this strikes me as the kind of thing that you don't hear at the supper table in most American households, and yet you, as a historian, are making a serious argument that it manifests itself in this family.
I talked to Walker Percy about this, and I said to him, I said, you know, those wonderful stories that illustrate the concepts of Stoicism in uh-huh. Will Percy's Lanterns and Levy, I said, aren't those family stories, aren't those things that you heard as you grew up? And he says, oh, yes. Everything in that book is something we heard.
So it was there.
It was there uh-huh. all the time, yes. And of course, Will has a wonderful chapter on his experiences during the First World War, and the kind of recklessness, almost, that he with which he went into battle, and this idea of serving one's country is extremely important, I think, to Will and I think to Walker as well.
Would you say that one of these words, honor, melancholy, imagination, in the Southern family, the Percy house, the house mm-hmm. of Percy, does one of them dominate? Is it important? In what way should we understand their relationship in this family?
Well, we haven't really talked too much about the question of melancholy here, and so we might just mention something about it, because I think it is very much connected with the idea of imagination and honor as well. In a larger framework, and this is one of the major themes of the book, many artists that have in Western society have suffered from chronic depression. Now, there are several sources of this. One is, of course, genetic. That is, one can be subject to a predisposition towards a melancholy state of mind, and that that there can be a chemical factor that's involved. We can see this, for example, in William Styron's Darkness Visible.
Exactly.
In which he talks about his genetic problem, basically, his chemical problems with depression. And, of course, we have Prozac and other mm-hmm. Substances now that can help to alleviate that. But there can also be early loss of family, a parent or mother or father, early in a young child's life, and in order to deal with this terrible sense of anger and repressed grief and so on, It somehow it seems to stimulate the imagination.
Well,
and so we find that there is a connection between the imagination and creativity of literary folk, or it could even be in science or politics and other things as well, but in literature especially we find that there's a connection.
Well, I was going to say, in the instance of Walker Percy, we have a man who looks back five or six generations and finds not manifestations, but a kind of pattern. And I believe that you have observed that Walker Percy himself was fearful. There was an angst in his life about whether he himself would repeat this terrible pattern of loss and, in fact, suicide.
Yes, and one could argue that in a certain sense, the process of writing something out is a kind of a therapy. Unfortunately, it doesn't cure, but because the feelings are still there. But it can be a stimulus to the imagination. Somehow, I talked to him about this. He mentioned, for example, when I was talking to him about the relationship of his art to this series of suicides that were in the family and series of cases of severe depression, and what relationship that might have to his writing. And he said, Carl Jung once put it this way, dig down in the depths, there's gold there. And so that he felt that it was out of his depression. Of course, he said, when you're really in a terrible state of depression, you can't do much. I mean, you're paralyzed emotionally and benumbed in a sense. But in the hypomanic stage, as it's called, there can be an outflow of great creativity. And we find this in Dostoevsky and or in music, in Beethoven, Schumann, and so on.
You use the word therapy, Bert Wyatt Brown. Is it fair to say that in his novels, in his art, Walker Percy found a kind of, what, temporal or secular salvation or balm for his life? I'm thinking of the fact that he's a very religious man at the same time.
I'm afraid, yes, that there are the two sides of it. That is, the his interest in religion, I think, stems in part. Now, I wouldn't want to say that it has not everything that a writer writes about has to deal with his internal problems or the history of his family or something of that sort. There's something beyond. But in his case, certainly, there was a very strong spiritual element. And this also was inherited. I think he really obtained this, had that spirit from his own father, original father, Leroy Pratt Percy, who was very interested in theology. And then Will Percy himself, although he became an agnostic, made a religion of Stoicism, and there was a certain mystical quality, I think, in his own writing and in his own behavior that Walker Percy obtained as well from him.
Bert, as you look at Southern families, here you've written this book called The House of Percy about the concepts of honor and melancholy and imagination. Is this what you see on the horizon for Southern family-ness? Are we talking about one specific family rather than a kind of regional sense of identity? How about that?
That's a very tough question in a sense, because this is a very unique family. There's not going to be too many families, I think, that we can trace so well as this. We have a few. Of course, there are the Breckinridges of Kentucky, General Lee's family in Virginia, very prominent upper-class families with extensive documentation and records that are left.
The Kennedys and the Roosevelts, the James family come to mind.
Sure, and the Adams family, the Lowells. But interestingly enough, in the South, we don't have so many. Particularly the Southwest, there are not too many families of this character that we can trace that well. I would hope, though, that what I hope for the book is two things. First, that there will be interest among historians in dealing with family culture as they would deal with regional culture.
Well, this is a relatively new topic for historians.
Well, I think it is.
Records are back there.
But the records are there, there have been histories of families before. I don't claim any originality on that score, but generally it's less to expose the culture of the whole region. I see and try to portray the Percys as both atypical and typical, in a sense. Many of the traits that they possess are peculiar to them, perhaps, but they are reflections of a larger culture. The second point I'd like to make about this is that there are many people in this country that suffer from depression. It may be 10 million to 19 million members of our national family, you might say, that have this illness, or to some degree at least, suffer from depression. And what I'd like to think is that this book helps to show how it can be dealt with. And this family is one, I think, that is almost inspirational in its heroic ability to overcome this problem.
Bert, you allude to the Percy women in writing The House of Percy. Have you got a favorite story about one of these people?
Well, Sarah Dorsey is one of my favorite characters, and she dominates the middle of the history. She was a great friend of Jefferson Davis. In fact, so great a friend that she invited him to live on her estate in Beauvoir, near Biloxi, Mississippi.
And this was something of an outrage, wasn't it?
Absolutely, because her family, of course, was outraged. And Verena Davis, Jeff Davis's wife, was, of course, thoroughly put out because she was over in England at the time and couldn't get back fast enough to prevent this from happening. And so a scandal kind of developed about all of it. And Jeff Davis actually was probably not in any kind of sexual relationship with her. Neither one of them, I think, were likely to have engaged in that sort of affair. But nevertheless, certainly the rumors did swirl about. Verena finally was induced to come and visit. And so she arrived on the scene, and Sarah had prepared everything for her, that there'd be this enormous reception and dinner party. I think something like 300 guests were going to turn up. And Verena unpacked her bags and then got into a fury about something or other and marched off into the woods as the guests were arriving, and they had to go out and search for her and bring her back and bring her to the party. And then, of course, she was all sweetness and light when everybody showed up. Sarah did end up giving all of her property to Jefferson Davis at her death. And irony of ironies, Mrs. Davis was to inherit that property after her husband's death, not that Sarah had actually ever willed it to her directly, and it became the Jefferson Davis Shrine.
Bert Wyatt Brown, again, your book is The House of Percy. Does the idea, the concept of aristocracy in American families, does that persist here in our mass culture in the 1990s?
Well, I think it does. Of course, it's a different culture now than, say, 100 years ago. There was much more sense of class and rank of society at that time than there is today. But I think in the South, and especially in rural communities or communities of smaller towns, one or two families will dominate and lead the community, make its contribution in a way which is probably not as likely to happen in a larger city. And I think that that may be characteristic of the South even today, in the rural areas, or the less populated areas anyway.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you to reflect on this as we move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Bert. What is the Percy legacy when we speak of, again, any or all of these three large concepts, honor, melancholy, imagination? How will the Percy legacy move into the next century?
Well, I think that a family that has as much integrity and as much talent as this one will probably continue to produce a succession of important figures. What nature that will be, I haven't any idea. But the strength of the family lies in its artistic abilities. Some are musicians. Some are writers today. I believe there's an Anne Percy who is related to the family and is a journalist. There are signs of great medical talent as well. And Walker Percy, as you may recall, was himself a physician.
Never practiced, but
he was a physician, trained at Columbia, and was a very brilliant one. He was going to become either a pathologist or a psychotherapist.
Well, for his readers, I think it's fair to say that he is a therapist after a fashion.
He provides the
great balm of art.
Yes, and apparently, in a rather informal way, people would come to him rather naturally because of his intelligence and his warmth and sympathy for advice. I mean, not that he was practicing illegally or something of that sort, but but he had that kind of ability. He would have been a great psychoanalyst, I believe.
Bertram Wyatt Brown is a professor of history at the University of Florida. His new book is The House of Percy, Honor, Melancholy, and Imagination in a Southern Family. The House of Percy is available from Oxford University Press. Bertram Wyatt Brown is also the author of The Literary Percys, an account of family history, gender, and the Southern imagination. The Literary Percys was published last year by the University of Georgia Press. In a moment, information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. Right now, we conclude with another reading by Bertram Wyatt Brown from The House of Percy.
With the exception of Walker Percy, the novelist, no other member of the family in the United States ever matched the subtlety and individuality of William Alexander Percy. Unpretentious and self-effacing, he exercised an extraordinary influence upon those around him. His circle of friends was enormous. Indeed, how easy it was to idolize Will Percy. He was a good man, but friends and relations refused to recognize him as the vulnerable, troubled human being he was. Some of his literary friends were acutely aware that behind the laughter and graciousness, a deep sadness enveloped him. Recalling Will Percy's quick temper, Walker Percy would remark that his first cousin, once removed, could shift so quickly from telling a funny story to a level, gray gaze cold with reproof. They were terrible and beautiful eyes, eyes to be careful around. Above all, Walker Percy added in recollection, I cannot see them otherwise than as shadowed by sadness.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was historian and biographer Bertram Wyatt Brown. Cassette tapes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. The address is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 760. That's $10. Program number 760. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. We're interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week, Crossing Ocean Parkway. Cultural critic Mariana DeMarco Targovnik of Duke University will be here to discuss her memoir about growing up as an Italian-American daughter in New York City. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.